Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah.
You do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science in a good way, as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
Now, we're currently in the thick of Movember, where people, grow out their tashes to raise awareness of men's health issues like prostate or testicular cancer.
It's basically a time of year when everyone has terrible facial hair, isn't it?
Yeah, or just people sort of experimenting in a way that they wouldn't be able to justify at any other time.
Yeah. What have you tried? Burt Reynolds? Tom Selleck?
I have a beard, but sometimes when I shave it down, I shave down in stages.
Yeah,
and then poke my head round the bathroom door to show Emma. She's like, oh, good God. So I've definitely done the Wolverine.
Oh, have
which
you?
Which is great, where you sort of, so almost Ooh. Like an inverted goatee
negative goatee, isn't it?
Yeah. And that is horrifying.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
I actually think I once had that, like, on camera. I think I was just like, well, fuck it. Like, you know.
Right, somebody Google that. Yeah.
But then I reckon every sort of probably every 6 months, I tentatively just have like a normal, sort of quote unquote, normal tash.
Do you?
Yeah.
I don't think I've ever seen that.
Beard is shorter and then the tash is a bit longer, which I think is the acceptable face. And even then, because I quite like it.
Right, even what then, does Emma think?
No. No, yeah, she's just like, have you done that again?
We talk about that
every time. I'm like sort of hoping she won't notice. It's like, yeah, but I do look at your face.
Yeah.
And I can see what you've done. Never really get away with it.
Well, this is my first, probably a year now with actual beard that I haven't bothered to shave off. like completely at some point. And now
I sort of imagine you always with a beard.
No, I never used to have one.
Ah.
But basically what happened was my family said to me, do you know what? Your face is now so saggy. You can't get away with like being clean shaven.
Let's have a look. Get away from there. I mean, it does. I think it looks nice.
Yeah, I think it's all right. So I'm going to stick with this. I've basically been told, you know, your face is not suited to actually somebody seeing it naked anymore.
Mm.
So I'm going for this. I did once have a goatee, which I had for about sort of probably about 3 or 4 weeks until people begged me to shave it off.
I think the goatee is...
I look like a Ukrainian bouncer.
Absolutely awful. Like, it's awful. I don't think... Yeah, is there anyone who can pull off it? Like, someone like Brad Pitt probably can, but even then, you just like, you look better without. I don't think anyone's face is enhanced by the goatee.
Rafa Benitez?
Yeah, actually, because imagine him, he'd look like...
You can't imagine him without
just
it,
like
can
a
you?
Sort of sagging potato.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
welcome
maybe.
To my world.
Yeah. But the thing about the beard is it's effectively, it's kind of like drawn on definition. Like
yeah,
it's a bit of jawline. Jawline,
it,
you're sort of convincing,
isn't it? Though,
yeah,
yeah, yeah. I did once do the whole.
It's, sort of it's Boy George, Boy George. Basically,
draw
did he
a
have
line.
It tattooed?
Yeah, yeah.
Like just almost like a sort of black sort of shadow tattooed under his neck.
Yeah,
so you can't sort of see what's going on under there. Amazing.
I did once have a Burt Reynolds, but it never made it out of the house. I was being encouraged to do it just for a laugh because I'd grown like a beard out, and basically some mates said, I reckon you could do a Burt Reynolds. We want to see you turn up at the weekend with a Burt Reynolds. And it just, I'll show you a picture later, but it wasn't right.
Well, what? Not right in what sense though?
It was just like, that isn't you. I think there's something about your personality that you need to carry it off.
Mm.
And I think it just wasn't me at all.
I think you've just got to dig in though, haven't you?
Maybe.
You've got to
turn into Lemmy overnight and
you've
start
got
drinking whiskey very heavily.
I don't know. I think you just have to go out there. And initially, like, everyone is going to be like, what the fuck are you doing? Brooksy? Yeah. Ridiculous. But after a while, you just condition people and they're like,
so you just style it out.
Yeah, like Brooksy's got a tash.
Yeah.
And then you're away.
All right, we'll see.
Yeah.
When I show you this picture, you'll say, dear God, no, don't ever do that.
I mean, it is high time that someone brought back the Hitler, isn't it?
My dad used to have a Hitler.
I think you've told me this before.
I mean, it's just, you know, it's a little patch like you haven't shaved,
yeah.
isn't it? It's like you came closer and closer and then somebody distracted
gave
you
up.
And you gave up.
But your dad's black, in fairness.
Yeah.
Black guy, every now and again, you will see a black guy with a Hitler.
Yeah.
And it is sort of fine. A white guy.
Robert
cannot...
Mugabe.
Well, yeah, Mugabe, but that felt more like an homage, though. But I think a white guy, you cannot do that.
No, you
as
can't.
As much as you say,
Richard
no.
Richard Herring tried
it's Chaplin,
as well,
it's
didn't
Chaplin.
He?
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, Richard Herring made a whole show about it.
Yeah, yeah.
But you feel
it's
like
not
it
the one
never...
to go for in November, I think.
Probably not.
No,
it's definitely the one that requires the most explaining.
It doesn't have comedy value, does it? You know,
unless you're doing physical comedy like
Charlie Chaplin.
It's just people being like, well, that's still unacceptable.
Yeah.
But at some point, I mean, it would make sense that at some point that would stop. Do you think?
No, I don't think it ever will.
Whose facial hair from 200 years ago is iconic? Like, you don't really know, do you?
No.
Do you think it's just...
Well, you think there's going to be a generation that doesn't remember what it looked like?
Not that, but it's just, I don't know, it just seems like such a... You know the sort of thing, oh, too soon. Like, there is going to come a point where, like, 200 years, like, so, you
that
know...
can't be in, too soon.
Yeah, in, like, 2145, 200 years after Hitler has died...
Hold the style pages, we've seen the new trend coming. It's going to take 120 years.
Yeah,
is that what you're saying?
Well, I don't know how long it is.
It won't
there
be
must
the Hitler,
be an amount
then,
of time.
It'll be called
something
else.
What I mean.
Yeah.
It might not be fashionable, but it surely won't retain the
it
awful
won't be socially
association.
Unacceptable, will it?
No. People, you know, some people would be like, "Oh, hang on, that's a bit like, you know, Hitler," and people would be like, "Who?" Well, they might not be like who, but it won't be so.
I wonder if they will.
Hmm. I think so. I think it has to fade. I think it has to.
Okay. But not
and
yet.
I wonder if it's you that this Movember. just
maybe next Movember.
Next Movember. Okay, yeah, well, I'll hold you to
maybe,
that.
Maybe.
I'm pleased to say that this episode actually has got nothing to do with facial hair.
Great.
We're actually doing something that I would argue is probably a bit more serious, but also relevant to Movember.
In what could be a major game changer, 14 patients with advanced rectal cancer are in remission after taking the same drug. The tumors are gone, with no chemo, no radiation, no surgery.
This is a time of dramatic development in cancer treatment, and immunotherapy will be a key part of a new era of smarter, more targeted drugs.
40 years ago, only 1 in 4 patients survived cancer. Now it's 1 in 2. And with these new treatments coming on, with the more research we're doing, we're getting faster and faster. And it's our hope that in 20 years' time, 3 in 4 patients will survive. And these immunotherapy treatments are going to be a part of that puzzle.
Today, more people are getting cancer, living with cancer, and dying from cancer than ever before. With a disease that affects more than 14 million people across the world, people have been left wondering whether we'll ever find a cure. But humans are a nifty bunch. We've harnessed electricity, sequenced the human genome, and eradicated diseases such as smallpox, so it's probably not wise to bet against modern medicine. That's why this week we're asking, can we beat cancer?
Wow, that's a big question.
Yeah, it is. It is, but I mean, it's a good question. It's a question that we've been asking for a while.
Yeah, it's a question I ask all the time when I get, you know, asked to sponsor Race for Life things, and, you know, it's just like...
Is my money...
I just sort of like, okay, you know, let's do this, but I cancer's hard, isn't it? I just know that cancer is hard.
Would you rather donate to a cancer charity or a cold fusion charity?
Cancer, yeah. It's not that hard.
Yeah.
It actually, you know, obeys the laws of physics, presumably.
I mean, I think I'll make a slight sort of disclaimer here in that, I mean, cancer can always get to fuck, can't it? But particularly for me at the moment in my family, cancer can really get to fuck. So I'm hoping that the answer is yes. And ideally, sort of in the next, you know, like 18 months or so.
Oh, really?
It'd be really handy for me.
Yeah, okay. Well, I'll up my donations then.
Yeah, if you would. Yeah. But I also, I'm into cold fusion, so maybe dig deep. Today we're joined by Dr. Kat Arney, a science writer and broadcaster. Her latest book is Rebel Cell, Cancer, Evolution and the Science of Life. It's about challenging old ideas regarding cancer with a new way of thinking. And it basically looks at what cancer really is and its role in human life and life generally. Dr. Kat is also the host of the Genetics Unzipped podcast.
All right. Are we promoting her podcast?
I think she's generously given up her time to talk about her work. I think it's fine.
Also, she kind of does work that matters, as opposed to us.
Well, yeah. I think I'd feel uncomfortable not plugging her fine work.
I mean, basically, she's much better than us, and we should just admit it.
Yeah, we'll happily admit that. But I didn't spend a great deal of time sort of dwelling on the fact she does a podcast.
Oh, yeah, okay.
But I did say to her...
She's not inviting us on hers, though.
Well, we don't know. Let's just do a great episode here.
we can tell you all about Hitler.
Now it's moustache. Is that what you need?
His moustache is coming back.
21:45, Kat. So, no, the first thing I asked her was, how long... All right, I suppose this is... I think there's a sort of... a vague myth around cancer that it's this sort of modern disease and it's modern life that has suddenly brought it to the fore. But that is what it's done. It's not that it hasn't been around. Like, it's been around pretty much forever.
Right.
But we're just seeing it more. And largely because we're living longer. And so the longer you live, the more likely you are to see kind of stuff going wrong.
Right, so we've basically eliminated the other stuff that gets us earlier.
Yeah. Okay. And which is why, you know, so if you look at cancer rates and cancer-caused deaths across different populations globally now, you'll see loads more in sort of Western, highly developed countries, but just because life expectancy is higher.
Right.
Whereas if you go somewhere where life expectancy is lower, you see much less cancer. But that's just because people aren't living long enough for the cancer to take hold.
Yeah, yeah.
So I asked Kat about that and said, you know, how long then have humans been dealing with cancer?
It's a really common idea that cancer is a modern disease and it's a uniquely human disease. And as I was researching my book, Rebel Cell, I wanted to really dial back to the very earliest days of life on Earth to discover that it's not, because we find cancer across the animal kingdom. Pretty much everywhere you look, every species can get cancer. You know, from the very simplest one is something called a hydra, which is basically a little tube with tentacles, and cancers have been found in these, and it's incredible. And we know that it goes across the animal kingdom, so that tells us this is a deep evolutionary phenomenon. It tells us that it also goes a long time back in history. We can find dinosaur fossils with cancers. The week my book came out in the UK, there was a new dinosaur fossil described. It was, I think, you know, millions and millions, tens of millions of year old dinosaur fossil with an osteosarcoma. That's a bone tumour. And humans get that type of tumour too. So this tells us it's a very ancient disease. Everywhere we look in populations of human remains, we find evidence of cancer. There are mummies with cancer. There are bones with cancer. There are populations with cancer everywhere we look. So it's not a human disease. It's a disease of multicellular life. If you have many cells, those cells could go wrong. And it's a very ancient phenomenon, presumably as old as multicellular life itself.
So the idea that it is a sort of new modern phenomena is absolute rubbish. And you can see cancers in dinosaurs and pretty much in every area of the animal kingdom.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
And as far back as, so I think the oldest one that I saw mention of was something a bit like a sea turtle, but from like 250 million years ago. And this fella had cancer.
I quite like that. There's something in me that quite likes the idea that, oh, you find cancer in all those, like,
yeah,
like
yeah,
she mentioned,
yeah,
like fossils, yeah, dinosaur fossils.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's incredible to me.
Yeah.
And it just does. It's not what you think, is it? It's not how you think about how those animals die. And
it's quite
like
counterintuitive. But interestingly, I think what we don't know is whether these animals were
dying of cancer,
whether they had them, which is kind of an interesting thing to bear in mind throughout this episode, which is it's not necessarily true that having cancer will kill you. You might be able to manage it or just have a tumour that is relatively benign, and so it's kind of like all these things. It's not black and white.
Yeah. Okay.
And all the way through history, there has been examples of people identifying cancer in themselves and in other animals. I mean, you wouldn't call it a cancer, right? But you can look at growths that plants get that have some similar properties.
Oh, really? Okay.
Where sort of, you know, where something has gone wrong with the cellular machinery and you get these kind of mutations and growths. Even things like mushrooms, you can see something similar. So it does feel like, as Kat said, if you're a multicellular life form, you are vulnerable to cancer or something like cancer.
But you hear people say, don't you, it's like, oh, it's pesticides or it's plastics.
Or, you know, all these carcinogens in modern environments. And you're like, well, listen, they aren't helping. No one's saying they're helping. And they may actually be increasing the incidence, but they're not suddenly creating this thing. Yeah. It is everywhere. And there's some amazing stuff like, there's an Egyptian queen or some high up Egyptian lady from a long time ago, you know, thousands of years ago, who sort of identified that she had breast cancer and sort of diagnosed, well, I'm going to have a mastectomy.
Wow.
And this is before anyone would have had any idea what cancer was. But I think people were pretty, certainly with sort of surface cancer where you could see the growth, people were like, well, that's not good.
Let's get rid of that.
Let's, if possible, let's get rid.
Yeah.
And also, I've mentioned the fact that, you know, all sorts of animals get cancers. And you better believe I'm going to be coming back to that because
we're not
going to
major on animals, though, are we?
We're not going to major on animals.
Thing, but
we are going to. It is relevant.
Okay.
There's some relevant, interesting stuff. And it was a guy...
God, we're going to get octopuses with cancer or something.
Oh, can you imagine? I mean, I think... Well, do you know what?
Oh, here we go.
One thing that might help the octopus would be very short lifespan.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah. Short lifespan is pretty ideal in terms of avoiding it, because just less time for cancers to develop, less time for yourselves to come.
I mean, I'm sure they're not feeling great about it, because there's other stuff that gets them, like, well, you know, like reproducing.
Yeah. But they might be, they might not be that affected. But if you kept an octopus alive for long enough, would presumably be vulnerable to cancer.
Right.
But we'll come back to all that. All right. don't you worry. So the first guy who gave it a name was Hippocrates, famous sort of father of medicine, Hippocratic Oath. That guy, Greek, presumably. Sounds Greek.
Always.
And he was sort of looking at these tumours, and he called them carcinomas, carcinoma.
Yeah.
Basically means crab in Greek. And the reason he said that, and it's quite gross, is that the sort of, if you imagine like a surface tumour or sort of opening up and looking at a tumour, you've got this kind of mass of cells, and they kind of end up like hijacking blood vessels. So you've got this kind of like web of blood vessels going into and supplying the tumour.
Right.
And they kind of look a bit like legs. So the whole thing is sort of like the hard body of the crab, and then it's blood vessel legs. Nasty.
That is nasty.
But that's why it's called cancer.
Okay.
And then...
it's nothing to do with star signs.
Nothing whatsoever to do with star signs. It's not only people born at that time of year that get cancer. And there was another guy...
That's a Taurus. I wouldn't mind that.
Was he called... Yeah, me too, actually. Yeah, fine. Yeah. But what would we get as bulls? Was he called Galen? Is there someone famous called Galen?
Yeah.
So he would have been around a bit later than Hippocrates. But he was one of the sort of... Everything's caused by... imbalances in the four humours. So blood, phlegm, and then the two yellow and black biles. And I think he thought, I mean, whatever, like, you got too much black bile, that's obviously what's doing it. But that's the kind of thing that persists for ages.
Yeah.
And pretty much until the Enlightenment, when people start doing proper sort of anatomical investigations and drawings like Michelangelo did of the human body, and they start drawing these kind of features, and people then sort of realize, okay, probably not going to be these four humors we've been talking about. The point is, we've been aware of cancer and aware of it not being good for a long time, but it is only fairly recently that it started to kill people in large numbers.
Yeah,
which is when we've really started to pay serious attention to it.
Okay. And that's basically when our life span just expanded massively.
Yeah. So sort of post, I guess it's sort of Industrial Revolution, really, isn't it? When people are going to start getting significantly older. So it's not that long.
And do we know what it is? You know, tell me what cancer actually is, or is it impossible to define?
No, I mean, the sort of odd thing is, it's not actually one disease. It's sort of a family of very closely related diseases, sort of hundreds of them actually, but they're all caused by cells going wrong and then sort of growing out of control. So they multiply quickly, and then the real problem, if they multiply sort of in situ where the problem is, that is not as bad. And if so, effectively, you catch it early, if you can whip it out or destroy it, however you decide you want to try and do that, while it's in place, great. If it breaks away and then starts spreading through the body, which is called metastasizing, then that is much harder, because then it sort of is invading, breaking away from where it started, and can start populating different places in the body. And that's sort of really where cancer takes hold and it's going to be fatal.
Right.
Unless you manage to intervene in some way. And that's what we're trying to do.
Okay.
All right. I mean, obviously catching it early is always going to be the best version, I suppose.
Yeah. All right. So I understand the thing about, you know, cells going out of control and some of them go through the body and they metastasize. But I also hear like, oh, it's a benign tumour or it's a malignant tumour. Mm. And it doesn't sound like anything's benign if it's sort of, you know, growing out of control.
Right. Well, actually, so a benign tumour is one that doesn't spread through the body effectively. So if it stays, so if it remains localised in the area which it originated, and also, so it will slightly depend where it is. So obviously there's not really such a thing as a benign brain tumour.
Yeah, because you don't want...
I mean, it's going to be, it could be sort of levels though, but so you can certainly have like benign tumours on your skin.
Yeah,
reasonably common. It's not escaping that area. It's not infecting other parts of the body. But if they get into your circulatory or your lymphatic systems, that's when you would say this is malignant.
Okay.
So effectively, there's a dividing line. It's sort of about the behaviour of it rather than a sort of clear definition of, you can immediately say, well, that would definitely be benign or that would definitely be malignant.
All right. Okay. All right. And we're sort of, you know, learning how, obviously, if you've got a benign tumour, people just usually just get them cut out, I think. But, you know, there's lots of other treatments that people face once they have a tumour, especially, obviously, a malignant tumour. We're sort of, you know, getting better at treating it, aren't we? We're sort of doing okay.
Yes. So there was a really interesting thing in the States in the early 70s where Richard Nixon sort of declared war on cancer.
Oh, yeah, yeah. The war on cancer, yeah.
Yeah, and I think partly, and which is a great thing to do, but I genuinely think that the sort of scientific community was so buoyed by the fact that we'd just gone to the moon that it felt like, well, of course
we'll
be able to...
Oh, we can do anything, yeah.
Of course we'll be able to deal with cancer.
Yeah.
You just chuck, like, well, like with the moon landings, you're like, Jesus, how do we manage that? We threw so many resources at it,
yeah,
effectively, and we
brains and
we,
money,
yeah, brains yeah. and money. If we do the same thing with cancer, we'll get it done. And you know, truth be told, we didn't get it done. And in the 80s, sort of people had and there was a lot of money going in, but people had a look at the sort of the state of play, if you like. And the situation hadn't improved. Like more people were dying of cancer, and so that I think led people to start trying to look at it in different ways. And there are all kinds of different angles and approaches you can try and take. And most of the treatments actually came out of other sort of, and this happens a lot in medicine, I think, and maybe a lot in science generally, where you're sort of doing one thing. Expecting a result, and then you're like, oh, that's interesting, that could be used for... Huh. So x-rays, when people first developed x-rays,
yeah.
And then they were like, oh, this radiation can damage cells. I wonder if there's a way of doing that in a kind of focused way, and we can start... radiotherapy.
Yeah.
And radiotherapy is... It used to be a really blunt instrument, in that, yes, you could kill the cancer cells, but there's no way of it discriminating. And so it's just going to kill a load of cells, and it can be absolutely brutal. And now we're able to focus it much more carefully, sometimes actually now through radioactive sort of targeted drugs. So they'll go to the site in the body and you know, all kinds of ways. But that came out of x-rays. The first type of chemotherapy came from mustard gas. And so that was obviously developed as a weapon of war.
Yeah.
Pretty brutal. But people kind of realized where you could fiddle about and do something with this where you target cells. And again, the problem is always, how do you get your treatment to target just these cells rather than any of your healthy cells? Because if you're attacking everything, you're going to give yourself problems.
I mean, I can see how you can focus a beam of radiation, but chemo just sort of floods the body, doesn't it?
Yeah, and it like wipes out your immune system, so your white blood cell count goes down drastically, which effectively means you're very vulnerable to any other infection. So if you get anything else while you've got chemo, that is a real issue.
But it still, it does work.
Yeah.
In many cases, I guess.
Yeah, and we're Yeah, I mean, we are getting better at it. I think that the most promising avenue is probably sort of very personalised treatments, and they're all kind of genetics based, actually.
Okay.
And that's something that is definitely ongoing. But there are all sorts of hurdles. Like, yes, there's loads of money in this potentially, but these drugs and therapies are expensive. And so I actually asked Dr. Kat, what are some of the biggest barriers that cancer scientists are currently facing?
There are challenges when it comes to testing cancer treatments, in that if you are testing more than one treatment at the same time, that can be a bit challenging. Because, you know, the regulatory authorities, they like to know, oh, it's one drug, but it may be that this only actually works in combination with another drug, or it needs to be in a certain timing. So it can be quite difficult to design effective clinical trials and then get that approved by the regulator, get the right kind of data to show that this works. And so I think this is a challenge. It has been a challenge in the past, because obviously if you can't show that your drug works by itself, then how can you get regulatory approval for it to work with something else? And so I think there is enlightenment starting to happen. I think one of the other big challenges that we have is just in the way that treatments are being developed and tested and approved, in that really at the moment, all a pharmaceutical company has to do is demonstrate that their new treatment is just a bit better than an old treatment. So it doesn't have to be curative. There's no kind of bar for how much it has to improve survival by. It just has to improve survival. And there's a doctor called Vinay Prasad who talks about this, and he's like, you'll get rewarded if you pass your exams with a D, so why try for an A? And so I think we've sort of seen a lot of just trying to get new treatments over the line. And I think that really does need to come to an end, and we need to find more effective ways of approaching this problem.
I suppose there's a slight issue with the way that we frame the discussions around cancer, which is we're looking for a cure for cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah,
there is definitely not going to be a single cure for cancer. I think that's pretty clear.
Yeah. And we already have different drugs that work better for different cancers, don't we?
Yeah. I'm quite nervous about sort of bigging up any result too much, because I think there's a lot of that.
Yeah.
And I think it's quite, it can be quite sort of psychologically difficult for people with cancer sort of seeing quite grabby headlines about stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you see a headline saying, this cancer drug looks like it's working perfectly.
Yeah.
And they're immediately like, why aren't I on that?
Yeah.
I should be on this.
Yeah.
I'm not getting the right thing. Like, it's just sort of, it's tricky. And I think you have to be careful. But with all that said, in June this year, I think it was June, there was a really small trial. So there's 18 patients who've got who had rectal cancer, and all of them had gone through some really like tough treatments. So
yeah,
chemotherapy and radiotherapy and surgery. A lot of them, you know, needing like colostomy bag. Like, they're, you know, in quite a bad, so sort of effectively the kind of people where you're like, look, are you up for just trying this thing? And they're like, well, fuck it. Like,
yeah.
At this point, like, why not? And so they all took this drug that is called dostarlimab.
Right.
Yeah, whatever.
Never heard of it.
No. But you might do in the future. So they took this drug and cancer vanished in all of them.
What?
So, you know, so all of the available scans. Sometimes you can miss cancer, but they've done everything that we know how to. Yeah, exactly. They've done the MRI scans, they've done endoscopies, they've done physical exams. They're as sure as they can be that it's just gone in all of them. They don't need further treatment. And it's genuinely like, everyone's a bit like, I mean, quite cautious, because I don't think it's ever happened before with a cancer treatment.
Yeah,
hit rate. And so, but it's sort of, I haven't given it the preamble of don't get too, that is quite exciting.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're kind of done. They don't need my money anymore.
Yeah. Give it to the Cold Fusion guys. So that's pretty... That feels like a cause for optimism. But that is just one very specific type of cancer. So yeah. Rectal cancer.
Okay.
But pretty good.
But if it is that good, I mean, everything in me, alarm bells are ringing. It's like, there's going to be so many caveats to this, presumably.
Well, I mean, the first and obvious caveat is 18 is a tiny trial.
They're all very advanced.
Very advanced, but you'd sort of think that would make it harder, more impressive.
Yeah. Okay. I'm looking for the kind of Achilles heel of the whole thing.
Yeah.
Really.
I think at the moment, everyone's like, well, we can't see a reason not to celebrate this.
Yeah. It's funny because every time I see one of those headlines, I just never read that thing.
No.
Because I'm just like, oh God, here we go. Another false hope, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think this is one where it's legitimate to offer some hope, I think.
Right.
In a sea of articles which really have no... the articles are normally sort of fine. Or certainly when you get to the end, anyway, when they do a disclaimer at the end of like, "Oh, we only did this in mice."
I mean, you should probably also say that, you know, you don't have any shares in the company that makes this thing.
Oh no, I do. Yeah, yeah, no, I do. Yeah. As soon as I read about it back in June, I was like, "Yeah, cash me in, baby." So it's called. Let me find it again. Dostar Limab. I highly recommend it to everyone.
So irresponsible.
The medication, and this you'll like, and you can see why I invested. It's every 3 weeks for 6 months, and it costs $11,000 per dose.
Oh.
So this guy is catching.
So amazingly, they're not giving it away for free. You know, they've done something great for humanity, and yet they're still saying people have to pay for it.
Well, I mean, I guess at this stage...
I mean, who'd have thought?
Yeah, but at this stage, I mean, what else could they do? I mean, I suppose that's the cost. They're not.
This is the problem,
isn't
it?
They're not charging the patients.
No.
They're just saying that is the current cost.
Researching these things costs so much money.
I mean, loads of money. And we'll get into some more of the issues and the improvements and advancements in the cancer field, as well as cancer in animals.
Obviously.
Yes. And the breakthroughs that sort of newer technologies are offering us in cancer research. And we'll try and answer today's question, can we beat cancer? After this short break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
All right, because I know I have to ask this.
I'm ready for the question.
Tell me about the animals that don't get cancer. Presumably there's more than one, isn't there? I know about the naked roll mat.
The naked
roll mat. I didn't know about that until I said it. But there's others. Like there's sharks, I think.
Let Dr. Cat answer the question first, and then I'll bring in my stuff, okay?
Fill in the gaps.
There are a few kind of heroes in the animal world that are always held up as the examples of, these are animals that don't get cancer. So one is the naked mole rat. These are very, very cool animals. They're basically like a sort of a little sausage with teeth. They have very unusual lifestyles. They live in colonies like bees. They have a queen and kind of asexual workers. It's fascinating. They have weird thermoregulation. Their body temperature's regulated weird. Very strange animals. Their skin's all kind of stretchy and odd. And it was thought that they did not get cancer. There have now been some cancers described in naked mole rats. So, yep, they're now on the list. Also, there's a kind of rumour that sharks don't get cancer, and this is not true. There have been cancers found in sharks, including a great white shark was found with a cancer. The downside of this myth is that millions and millions of sharks have been killed to make traditional medicines that are meant to be have anti-cancer properties, and it's just simply not true at all. It doesn't work at all. So that's been really unfortunate.
I think, on the whole, as discussed right at the start, pretty much everything gets cancer.
Right.
But there are some exceptions. So I did find, I read about.
Your own research.
I was swimming in the ocean. But there's a sort of sponge that can withstand about, like, I think it's like 100 times the dose of X-ray radiation that would kill a human. And okay. And it just seems incredibly resistant to cancer. So it's this sponge, and there's a comb jellyfish.
Right.
Both of which can't seem to find any cancer in. So they're, okay. I mean, yeah, they will get studied more.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas the naked mole rats, now they've found cancer in them. It's just like,
naked mole rats out. But they are amazing, naked mole rats.
I didn't know that thing about them living in colonies.
Yeah.
That's just mad.
Yeah.
Do you think they've just found them with cancer because they've started eating non-organic vegetables?
I don't think they have started eating non-organic vegetables.
No?
No, I think they're still... I think they're pure
organic. Too much plastic and... No.
No.
It's just they've always had cancer, haven't they? Nobody's looked hard enough.
I think probably, yeah. Yeah.
God damn it.
Sometimes it's not that easy to find.
Yeah,
Especially if it's not producing any symptoms. You don't really know where to look, and it can be really quite small.
Yeah, and you can't go around sampling all the naked roll mats.
Will you stop calling them roll mats? Actually, no, carry on, I like it. Now, I have got one more bit of animal stuff for you, but I think you'll really like this. So there's a phenomenon called... Peto's paradox, or maybe Peto's paradox, named after the...
I've heard of that, but I couldn't tell you what it is.
Biologist, or I think maybe like statistical biologist who first noticed it. I think it was in the 70s. And the basic idea is, if you are a multicellular life form, big if for you, but if you are, then the more cells that you have and the longer you're around for, the more vulnerable you should be to cancers.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because there's more cells and they're around for longer, so there's more of them and more time for them to go wrong.
Yeah.
That just sort
just
of...
Just maths.
Intuitively, you're like, yeah,
yeah.
I've got that. But that's not really what you see. So you would imagine that a whale would be absolutely riddled with cancers.
Yeah.
But they aren't. And certainly not, and not to say that they don't get cancer, but they don't get it like wildly more than something else.
Okay.
And if you look at a mouse versus a human, the sort of incident levels are roughly the same. And you'd think, well, the mouse is unlucky there. Like, yeah. We've got so many more cells.
Yeah.
And we're outliving it by a factor of, I don't know, 20, 30?
Yeah.
Something like that. And if it's a lab mouse, a lot more than that. So it doesn't really make any sense. And people have tried to figure out what might be going on. And there's a few ideas. One is it's just a sort of evolutionary thing. And so literally, if you're going to be a big old unit and you're going to be vulnerable to cancers, you need to just be a bit better at withstanding them. And so there's a sort of, I'm not really going to get into the genetics of it because it's too difficult fundamentally.
Yeah, okay.
And I think we'll just get in a muddle. Yeah. And I think we should just sort of leave it at there are sort of genetic markers and there is definitely a genetic element to the formation of cancers.
Okay, right.
And there are kind of vulnerabilities within your genome.
People can read Kat's book if they want that.
Yeah, exactly right. Or listen to our excellent podcast. There's this idea that maybe like bigger animals, even like a dinosaur, say.
Yeah.
It may have just had sort of more, you'd almost need more to go wrong in their cells for cancer to develop.
Okay.
So they
raised the bar, basically.
It raised the bar slightly. So now we don't really have any evidence for that, but that's one sort of model that could explain it.
Yeah.
So actually just bigger animals, yes, they're getting cancer, but the threshold is higher, so they can withstand more sort of genetic changes without it giving them a problem. So that's one idea. The other idea that to me I absolutely love is this idea called hypertumours. So, the premise is my enemy's enemy is my friend.
Okay.
So you've got a tumour, not great, and then after a while, one of the malignant tumour cells also goes wrong and stops so that they all... Again, this is complicated, but all of the tumour cells sort of work together. That's how they get a blood supply and stuff.
Yeah.
They sort of work in concert. If one goes wrong and isn't and is now working not with the rest, it effectively, and then it starts dividing, it's a tumour on the tumour.
Oh.
And it can start interfering with the operation of the tumour. So it can start like hijacking its blood supply. And so effectively, you stop that tumour. And so people think that, in fact, if you're able to look, and again, it's almost impossible, but in a whale, you might actually find there are loads of tumours, but on them, there are these little hypertumours that have taken charge. I mean, I don't know.
So the tumours effectively become incompetent and just not doing its job as a whole because it's been undermined.
It's like,
undermined from the inside, isn't
it? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But exactly what has happened to the host body has then happened to the tumour.
Taste of your own medicine.
Yeah. It's you know, shoes on the other foot.
Yeah.
How do you like it? You don't. And I think that's a really... that's my favourite explanation.
Of
where Peto's paradox might come from.
I like that.
Yeah, tumour on tumour. And then presumably it's a sort of...
It's a free-for-all, isn't it?
Is it Russian dolls, kind of? Is that little tumour getting a tumour on it? A tumour? I don't know. Very weird. Very weird.
All right, so it's all very well studying animals, and obviously thank you for all the animal facts.
No problem.
But we've got technology now, haven't we? I mean, don't we have the kind of ways in that are just purely like information-based? You know, we must be able to kind of look at cancer now and say, okay, throw a load of technology at it, actually we can do quite a lot. We don't really necessarily have to look at animal models. We're just like, we've got genetic information, surely.
Luckily for you, I actually asked Dr. Katniss.
It's absolutely blowing my mind to see how fast technology is going. So when I first started working at Cancer Research UK in 2004, we'd only just really got the first draft of the human genome. Sequencing was very, very expensive. The way that we found cancer genes was very slow and cumbersome even then. And just since that time, so, you know, this is less than 20 years, we've had endless revolutions in how we can understand genetics, how we can understand cells, sequencing whole genomes for, you know, less than $1,000, amazing technology for understanding genes and mutations, looking in tiny drops of blood for like single mutations and looking in single cancer cells. This technology is incredible. We've also seen real advances in looking not just at genes but at proteins, which is kind of the stuff, the building blocks of our cells. And that's been quite tricky before. It's not been very quantitative, it's not been very reliable, but we have much better technologies for doing that. And that's really the ultimate readout of the genes, is the protein. So I think we should need more attention on proteins and proteomics as we go forward. There's also the computational biology side. So we now have AI, machine learning, deep learning, that we can take data from all sorts of sources, from patient studies, from molecular studies, smush it all together, and the computer can spot patterns and connections and ideas and generate hypotheses that we can test. Churning through many, many, many different ideas for the shapes of drugs and combinations. I think there's a huge amount that has changed, and I think it's starting to get really, really, really exciting.
I do like the fact that, you know, despite Kat's obvious brilliance at this kind of stuff, she still says they smush it all together.
I mean, that's as good a description as any of machine learning, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. How does machine learning work? Well, you kind of take a load of stuff and you just smush it all together and then look at it.
But people, you know, we couldn't do that before. And that is one of the reasons that AI and machine learning can be so powerful in medicine generally.
Yeah,
it's just really good at pattern spotting,
especially when you've got all that information, like the genetic information. I mean, it's vast volumes, isn't it?
Yeah, but it's not just genetic information. That's the key, isn't it? It's like all sorts of environmental information and just everything in someone's medical records that you can suddenly start feeding in, and then, you know, it genuinely wouldn't be possible, I don't think, for humans to kind of sift through that amount of data and see anything emerging. But computers can do that.
Yeah.
And so that's really, I think that's really encouraging. And people are starting to do it. And there are ethical concerns around that, because it's a lot of data that you're taking from people and you've got to be careful to anonymize and all that kind of stuff. But you've got to say in this context, like, it just feels worth it, doesn't it?
Yeah, it feels like the right path to take, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah.
When you've got the kind of ability to compute all this and compare it and spot the patterns automatically, then, you know, why wouldn't you do it?
And
it's difficult, isn't it? Because, you know, we talked in our episode about what genetics will do next, about, you know, all the nightmare scenarios and the things that can go wrong. And, you know, Matthew Cobb, who was our expert, was quite sort of, you know, skeptical about some of the claims that geneticists make about what they can do and what they should do as well. But, you know, with this one, it seems like, you know, everyone surely is on side with us using genetics and AI to beat cancer.
Yeah. And genetics will be so key in this. I mean, there's some really sort of quite obvious questions that we still haven't got answers to about cancer, and questions that might not have occurred to you, be like, oh yeah. So something like, why is it that, so if you say, okay, 40 genes are causing cancers, and it looks like that. So there's 40 versions of a specific gene that appear to be strongly linked with breast cancer, specific gene strongly linked to bowel cancer. But why, given that those genes are present all through the body, would it only cause a problem in that part
in that
of the
one
body?
Area. Yeah.
And we don't really know that. And so you need to work with geneticists to try and figure it out. And that would be obviously really useful, because there's obviously some kind of tissue specificity that we don't quite get. but would be incredibly handy, particularly when, again, we come back to this idea of targeting.
So you can get that faulty gene in another area of the body and it just won't do anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like you, I mean, obvious point, you're not getting breast cancer in your arm.
No.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a load of other, I think, really sort of quite basic questions that people are still trying to answer. Combining treatments is a big one at the moment. I think people realizing actually one on its own, you're better off trying to lump treatments together, but figuring out how to combine them is difficult. And then obviously trying to work out which cancers are potentially lethal and need treatment and which aren't. Not that good at that. Why some cancers, I mean, I suppose this is the big caveat with the rectal cancer study, is there are some cancers that can seemingly have gone and you're in remission and then suddenly they're back. And we're not really sure what's happening there. Like if they're literally just hiding somewhere, or there's some kind of trace, some remnant that we're not spotting that then is waiting for an opportunity. Don't really...
Presumably you've cashed in your shares already in case that happens.
Yeah, just in case, because we're riding high at the moment.
And
then, you know, the really, I suppose, the biggest potential application for the sort of machine learning stuff is, can we just spot it earlier? Are there those cues that we don't know to
kind of screening
to look for?
Technology.
Yeah. Where you go, aha, that particular protein signature or whatever it is, that is an early precursor to this down the line. And we might, you know...
It'll certainly give you a probability association, won't it? A correlation, effectively.
Yeah, that's all they're ever going to give you, because it can't give you causation.
Yeah.
That's not what it's doing.
It's like your chances are increased and you need to be aware of that.
Let's have a look.
What about trials? I mean, is technology improving clinical trials?
It's such an obvious one, this, but it's obviously massively, massively improved trials, or has the potential to, because trials previously have always been in person at a centre, pretty much, you know, drawn from people who can get to the centre.
Yeah, so in the neighbourhood.
People in the neighbourhood.
Yeah.
And so it creates real problems in terms of your demographic.
Yeah, yeah, of
obviously.
Course.
Whereas now, you can do all this stuff virtually, pretty much.
Wow.
Like, there's not much need to go in. I mean, sometimes, probably, but you can do a lot of stuff just... like everything, just sort of on Zoom, and they can send you the medications and all of that. So you can do a pretty sophisticated consultation over.
That's fantastic as well. If you want to get recruited onto a trial, because you know you need to be on that trial.
And normally, if you weren't, so if you're in the UK and you're like, oh, but there's an incredible trial going on in the States before, well, that was not available. There was no way that could possibly happen. Because now, there is definitely a possibility.
That's cool.
I don't know if anyone is doing it across that kind of distance, because I imagine that there is probably still some sort of face-to-face stuff. But
you
can definitely see a world where you just get rid of that.
Yeah.
And it will just you can increase the size of your sample, which is great.
Yeah.
Massively improve the demographics, make sure that, you know, you're representing everyone. It's really good, actually.
Okay.
And then the other big sort of tech innovation, I suppose, is again quite recent. So there's this husband and wife team that you probably wouldn't have heard of that founded BioNTech.
No.
Do I
know BioNTech?
You do know BioNTech. Why do you know? Come on, dig deep. It's very, very contemporary. BioNTech, German company, quite new.
No, not ringing any bells.
No. Not paid any attention to the vaccines for COVID. No, nothing.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah. Oh, right, okay,
I'm only interested in British vaccines.
Well, if it's not the Oxford. Anyway, so the these two absolute dons came up with... they've been working on mRNA vaccines.
Yeah.
We do not need to go into why that is a new type of vaccine.
Yeah.
I think we can just wave a hand and say it's a new type of vaccine.
Yeah.
And through COVID, like we hadn't, It hadn't been out in the world. Now it's out there. It's working really well. It's the best possible massive trial you can have for that. And now they're trying to work on effectively a vaccine for cancers.
Wow.
And okay. it looks really promising. What's the sort of easiest way of explaining what you're doing? Well, yeah, so it's like having a description. It's like going into the body and you've got a description of like the thing that you want to kill.
Yeah.
And you go, this is the thing. And in the case with cancers, it's the antigens that distinguish cancer cells from normal cells. And mRNA vaccines are really good at this. And it is much, much, much more complicated than that. But
sweet assassins.
Yes, exactly. They'd started these trials way before the pandemic, and it had been encouraging, and now they're continuing. So the possibility of some form of mRNA based cancer vaccine is on the horizon, I would say.
Cool.
Yeah. Really cool.
So, you're sounding quite upbeat.
Yeah, I think so. I wonder if it's a sort of... cancer's always going to be around.
Yeah.
Cancer's always going to be there in everything. I think if you found an alien, decent-sized if, and a multicellular alien,
yeah.
I think they would probably have cancer. I think it feels like it's just a feature of having loads of cells.
Yeah.
Sometimes they go wrong.
Yeah.
And I think it's worth sort of accepting that. So whilst you might not be, we might not have cures for cancer, I think we'll just have ways of dealing with cancer when it arises.
And things that were a death sentence in the past are no longer in many cases and will definitely, not be in the future.
You're prolonging prolonging life massively, I think.
Yeah.
So, yes, it might kill you in the end, but instead of it being 2 years, it's 20 years.
Yeah,
That I feel pretty... And that is already happening in some areas, but I feel reasonably confident for everything that I've kind of read and heard that is a sort of reasonable supposition and hope.
Cool.
But I mean, to be fair, we also ask Kat this.
The question, can science beat cancer? I think I did sum up at the end of my book Rebel Cell, and it's this. It's that we need to tell a new story about cancer, not as something alien that we need to nuke from orbit, but as an intrinsic property of multicellular life. We have to understand it from the perspective of evolution and the ecology of the landscape within the body. We have to eradicate it if possible, steering cancer into an evolutionary dead end where every single cell has exhausted all the possible evolutionary avenues and extinction is the only option. Where that's not possible, the alternative is to keep chasing tumours round in circles, watching, waiting, treating, a situation that could continue for decades. And although that may not be the cure for cancer that we thought we were searching for, I think it's something that looks very much like it.
Well, okay, so we sort of agree then. I mean, her sort of...
phrased it better than you
did. She did phrase it better than me, yeah, I'll give you that. But she's written this fantastic book,
yes.
To be fair. She read a couple
Cell.
Of times. Yeah, very well.
Also, if you...
And her kind of, like, evolutionary dead end for cancer.
Yeah.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I imagine that her book as well doesn't skate over all the stuff that we've just skated over.
Honestly, I spent quite a long time reading about the genetic stuff, and it's really interesting, but Jesus Christ, my head is hurting.
Yeah, don't even get started on mRNA vaccines.
No, well, that's the thing. I'm just like, well, yes, we could, but we're going to be here for another hour.
Yeah, go and read Rebel Cell if you want to know about that.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Dr. Kat Arney. Please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. We also really love hearing from you guys. So if you have any burning questions you want us to answer, drop us an email at eureka@stack.london. Or you can find us, as always, on Twitter at EurekaPod.
Eureka is a Stack production.
and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. The future isn't scary, not realizing its potential, however, could be. Just like on the recruiting trail, I've seen potential come in many forms as a coach. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember. Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think, like, have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. And then we'll weigh around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.